This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, listen to the bite-sized business breakfast best bits from Tuesday, May the 30th. Right, coming up, we'll be hearing from Klaus Kajetski, the founder of Yalla Esports. This after the DMCC's latest Future of Trade 2023 report suggested that gaming revenues are expected to almost double by 2027 from 21 in the MENA region, reaching $6 billion. Which, of course, has got Klaus and others in the industry very excited. Jason Athton was in the studio as well. Jason is, of course, chef, restaurateur, businessman, and, of course, no stranger to Dubai, having opened his first restaurant or been working here since the early 2000s. Latest ventures here down at the Grosvenor House. We wanted to find out about those, but equally, why Dubai, how it compares to other markets. He has an international portfolio of properties around the world at the moment. And a little look at the industry as a whole here, whether the saturation was an issue or not. Good chat with Jason a little earlier on live in studio. We also had a chat with Faisal Durrani, who's a partner, head of Middle East research at Knight Frank. Well, according to them, global high net worth individuals have no fewer than $2.5 billion to spend on Dubai real estate this year. How we got to this figure is something that we asked Faisal and the rest of the team. Their latest research is out in terms of the market as a whole. Paints positive picture for the luxury end of the market until the end of this year.
Where we've got not one, not two, but three reports to get through this morning, and a number of moves on our financial markets as well. Let's start with the markets this morning. The future's so bright. As you've heard there in our business headlines, new futures contracts being offered associated with the Dubai Financial Markets General Index. We've been speaking this morning to Samir Lakhani, who's the Managing Director of Global Capital Partners, who's bullish on it. We asked him how much interest he expects to see.
The most actively traded futures exchange in the world is in India. By futures volume, it's 17.62 billion contracts last year, followed closely by Brazil. So there is a lot of exposure that is given by way of institutional investors entering into these markets by futures contracts. Back in the DGA, back closer to home in the DGCX, one of the most popular traded contracts is the Indian rupee, again in the oil. The cumulative trading volume at the DGCX was $162 billion last year. So the appetite is there, the interest is there. Yes, we also have some speculation that comes along with it, but that's just baked into the contract.
And we spoke to him about that interest. We spoke about what it could mean for retail investors and how risky, really, futures could be. Leverage, yes, but what are you actually risking? But we also had a look at what it meant for our ability to attract international money, institutional money into the DFM. Is this something that the type of pension funds that we want to see investing in our markets here want as a kind of insurance for their portfolios?
It's more efficient. Institutional investors that are looking for emerging market exposure and are looking to market portfolios, quote unquote, they have really two options. They buy ETFs, exchange traded funds, or they index futures. In terms of popularity, index futures win out handily, as is the example from the National Stock Exchange and the Brazilian Stock Exchange volumes indicate. Futures trading volume exceed ETF volume by a factor. And so it's an essential instrument for these institutional investors to increase their exposure to these regional markets.
So that's just one of the headlines that we are digging into this morning. We're also digging into a number of numbers, actually, that have come out from reports that have been released in the last 24 hours. Reports into the banking industry, reports into the gaming industry, and into the real estate industry here in Dubai as well. Let's start with gaming, because you just had a charming interview with our friendly Finnish gamer who ended up, and I could see Shruti and Isa cheering in the green room, by saying that he thinks the girls have got it.
Yeah, this is Claire Skajewski from Yala Esports. They've teamed up with Ahmed Bin Sulayem at DMCC to do an in-depth report on the video game industry. The headline is, it's going to be worth $6 billion by 2027. That's double 2021. It's growing very, very quickly. And it's not just people buying video games, it's developing video games and it's video games events and sponsorship of video games. And we were talking earlier on this morning, just intuitively, we felt it was more of a boys thing, but we didn't have any evidence to back that up. It just seemed like it was more a boy thing. But he says, yes, that is true, but not as much as you'd think.
Yeah, and I was particularly interested that he said one of the biggest changes that they've seen in this region in the sort of the gender mix when it comes to professional gamers, competitive gamers, is in Saudi Arabia, where he reckons that the split is near 50-50.
Yeah, that is really interesting, isn't it? I haven't been to a video game event in Saudi Arabia, but it would be fascinating to go. And we did mention that the PIF, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, has just spent $250 million on an esports company. So they're clearly taking this one seriously.
Oh, so seriously, they fly Georgia Tolly over for their esport events.
it would be great to be on the floor and see what's actually going on there. But there's certainly changes. But I do know when I went to Riyadh a couple of months ago for Cristiano Ronaldo's first game, and that was quite the fanfare. It was Riyadh All-Stars against Paris Saint-Germain, Messi, Neymar, Ronaldo. I mean, they were all there. And was it 50-50? Male, female, maybe not quite, but so many young Saudi women were there loving the football. It was noticeable.
Oh, that's one report we've been looking at this morning. We've also been looking at a new report that's come out from the guys at Knight Frank, having a look at the global appetite for the very high-end property. So your ultra-luxury villas being bought by high-net-worth individuals. These are the kind of clients that Knight Frank deal with. They're not dealing with the likes of me and these so much. But this report particularly was interesting because of the knock-on effect. So the headline of the report is kind of what you would expect. Yes, big appetite for rich people for property here in Dubai. We knew that. There's a shortage of luxury villas. We knew that too. But what's really interesting is what's happening because of that. So it's the fringes of this report. And it's a good 70 pages. I mean, they printed a book. It's hardcover. It's got pictures. And the knock-on effects of not having enough beachfront, for example, is the rise in parks. So your new sea view is a park view, as long as you've got a bit of openness in front of you. And it's something that Jean Jahenki said on this show before as well, from Property Monitor, because he used to live in New York, which has a very large park down the middle of it. And, you know, because you can't be built out, really. I mean, it would take quite a development for someone to be like, just going to take Central Park, stick some villas on it. So he said, you know, that what puts a premium on property is the airspace, basically, in front of it. And that's what we're starting to see here. If you can't get the oceanfront villa, having a park, particularly, and he talked about the different backgrounds of the high net worth individuals that they spoke to, and a lot from the much more condensed cities, and he spoke about the high net worth individuals that were coming from Asia, are already seeing the park space, that airspace in front of you, as a luxury.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
I mean, we have a number of reports that have been released in the last 24 hours that we're going through here on the Business Breakfast about banking, about gaming, and about posh property. Knight Frank has just put out its first ever annual Destination Dubai report. If you're watching on television, it's a book. It looks like a children's bedtime story. Not presumably unless your last name is Trump, because it is all about the property market and the city's global appeal to high network individuals. Very pleased to be joined in the studio now by Faisal Durrani, who is the head of Middle East research at Knight Frank. Faisal, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brandy.
And I'm less interested in the first couple of pages of this report, which tell us a lot of what we know, because you've been telling us for the last year, which is we're topping a lot of lists for the demand for ultra-luxury property, and there's not enough of it. There's not enough ultra-luxury villas to go around. That's not new. But what this report does dig into that's fascinating is a lot of the knock-on effects of that and how it's actually changing and influencing the market. Before we get into that, though, do put in context for us, when we say it's busy, how busy is busy?
The market at the moment is exceptionally busy. And in our report, what we've done is spoken to high net worth individuals from around the world. And what we see is that depth of appetite to purchase real estate in Dubai, not just residential, but any asset class, remains exceptionally strong. And the pockets are really very deep.
So you spoke to about 180 high net worth individuals from around the world. As a rule, apart from the very, very wealthy, the ultra high net worth, they're keen on apartments. Is that because that's all they can get?
They are keen on apartments, but I think there's also cultural factors at play there. So about a third of our respondents came from East Asia, so China, Hong Kong and Singapore. So it's quite likely that that is the type of stock that they're interested in slash familiar with. But it does get very interesting when you start segmenting by personal net worth. So people who've got a net worth of more than $10 million favor villas over apartments because they tend to give us access or them access to that Dubai lifestyle of sun, sand and sea, which is what international high net worth individuals are looking for predominantly here in Dubai.
And they want them built preferably, but recently so. How much stock do we have that fits into that category?
A very limited amount, Brandy. So you're right. Over half of them are very keen on something that is ready to move into. And this is, you know, a significant departure from what we've seen in previous market cycles. These buyers are actually genuine end users and second home buyers. Two-thirds of the high net worths we spoke to from around the world actually told us that they're looking to buy purely for use as a second home. And if we think about somewhere like the Palm Jumeirah, 18 years ago, when it was still a construction site, it would have been quite a difficult sell to an international buyer. We've now got a relatively completed community in place with schools, shopping malls, resorts in place, and it is quite a desirable place. And at the moment, we've got a very limited number of development sites available in a location like the Palm, which is why in the last 3.5 years, we've seen villa prices jump by a staggering 126%.
And it's also allowed you to identify top locations and waiting because, again, this report says the areas that the high net worth individuals favour, Emirates Hills, Palm Jumeirah, we know. But you're looking at what they might have to look at next. And where's that?
Exactly. So what we are doing is monitoring areas that are emerging as what we would define as prime. So these are areas where more than 10% of deals take place at over 10 million dirhams. At the moment, as you say, the Palm Jumeirah, Emirates Hills and Jumeirah Bay Island are the only areas that qualify. But we've got places like Jumeirah Islands, Jumeirah Gulf Estates, Al Barari, Tilal Al Ghaf that are quickly rising up the ranks and are likely to join our definition of what is classed as prime in Dubai.
And what's interesting about some of those areas that you've named is that they're inland. They are not coastal. You haven't got a sea view with that, which brings us to the rise of parks.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So in our survey, we actually asked global high net worth individuals what factors they consider in a residential community when thinking about purchasing property in Dubai. Parks actually topped that list. And what we found is amongst East Asian respondents, that preference for parks stood at 95%. So parks actually represent an excellent opportunity for us to create brand new communities inland, given that the city has virtually run out of easy to activate waterfront development sites.
Is it purely because at the moment you can't get the villa on the front that you'd want?
Precisely. There is extremely limited availability because what we're seeing in places like the Palm is properties are being bought at record prices. And we know that people are spending almost the same amount again on refurbishing these homes. And we see these sorts of trends in more mature markets where properties are bought and almost locked away from the natural cycling in the market because they are being used as second homes.
Well, how much could it add to the asking price for a property to overlook a green urban space, a park?
Usually, it takes you can look at anywhere between 30 to 35% of a premium to be looking directly at green space.
Does that mean that inland could become more desirable than seafront, or will seafront always have the edge?
I think from what we understand from high net worth individuals, just to gain access to that Dubai lifestyle, I think beachfront villas are probably where the demand will remain concentrated, and also it is in short supply.
Except that we're about to up the amount of public beachfront that we have by 400%. As you will be aware, you're in town for a couple of weeks from London. What is that announcement about our beaches, which was made at the end of last week? What's that going to mean for luxury property?
I think we'll have to wait and see how it actually pans out, whether or not that includes some of the already existing reclaimed islands where public beaches will be made available. But from what we've seen in the first phase, it's the Jebel Ali beach down at the base of the Palm Jebel Ali. So it will be interesting to see if any of those plots are unlocked. But again, should those communities be brought forward, like the Palm Jumeirah, it is likely to take some time before it is an established community. And this is what high net worth individuals want. They don't want to live on a construction site.
Oh, well, let's look at what else they want. Branded residents. You point out in your report that buyers like them. But I'm going to quote the email I was sent here. We've identified a prevalent issue of inflated prices that buyers need to watch out for. Are the branded residences that are going up overpriced?
So what we find amongst global high net worth individuals is that the bulk of them are looking to spend under $2,000 a square foot. So bearing in mind the type of stock that we've seen coming through in locations like Business Bay, we probably need to be a little bit wary off that top end price point. However, branded residences represent a really easy way for international high net worth individuals to gain access to that Dubai lifestyle. And it comes with the added bonus of luxury facilities and amenities and world-class property management. And that is what they're all looking for. Because what we found is while 45% of them told us they want to buy a branded residence for investment purposes, 30% told us they want to use it as a second home, and 13% say they want it as a primary residence.
Quickly, we've only got about 40 seconds left with you. What about oversupply? You say you need to be wary of some of those price points. The top downside risk that your European and UK people mentioned was the worry of oversupply here.
That's right. So we're currently tracking 94,000 homes due to be completed by the end of 2026. If we average that out over the next 4 years, it works out to about 23 or 24,000 homes a year. Historically, Dubai's had 35,000 homes a year delivered. So what we've got planned is still less than we've had historically. And in our prime neighbourhoods, we've only got 289 homes coming through.
So are you saying they're worrying about nothing?
They are potentially tarnished by the market's previous cycles, where we did have issues of oversupply. But right now, with Agenda D33 and this insatiable appetite from international buyers to purchase homes here, it does look like the market is going to remain slightly undersupplied.
Faisal Durrani is Head of Middle East Research at Knight Frank, coming in to discuss their Destination Dubai report. Thank you.
Thank you, Brandy.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
The chef, restaurateur, businessman Jason Atherton is no stranger to awards. He and his venues have picked up awards across the globe throughout his glittering career. That started out with Gordon Ramsay Holdings back in early 2000s. Not a million miles from here as well. We might talk about Verdun on the creek just a little while. Left Gordon Ramsay Holdings in 2010 after much success, set up his own company, his own restaurant company, the flagship restaurant Pollen Street Social, opened in April 2011, awarded a Michelin star within just 6 months as well. Since then, he has set up, along with his wife, the Social Company. It's grown into a globally renowned restaurant group, portfolio of restaurants across the globe. Two of the most recent right here in Dubai. He's here in Dubai cooking up a fuss as always. It's a warm welcome to the Business Breakfast to Jason Atherton.
Well, thank you for having me this morning.
Great,
I appreciate
to have
it.
You on board. And great to get perspective on the sort of hospitality industry globally. Who better to ask than a man who's got fingers in pies in many geographies around the world? I want to start with an interesting report that's just come out from the UK. I'm not sure if you've seen it this morning, but it comes out, it's been commissioned by four of the biggest hospitality organisations in the UK, British Institute of Innkeeping, UK Hospitality, Hospitality Ulster, amongst others, Top line on this, only a third of hospitality firms are optimistic about their future. The main reason being energy prices over in the UK at the moment. The findings on this one are quite interesting. It's collected data collected by CGA, by Nielsen IQ, on behalf of the groups, revealing that 86% of hospitality firms worried about energy costs going forward. Is that a current concern?
Absolutely, yeah, of course. I mean, if you look at Pollen Street Social, we would pay £7,000 a month to keep the lights on, all the energy bills, and it's now £27,000 a month. So you have to have a lot of depth in your margin to be able to survive just to turn the lights on, right, to where you were just, you know, pre-COVID. So it's frightening, you know. And if you're, you know, we're in a fortunate position where we're an extremely busy restaurant. Some of my colleagues who have got restaurants what are fantastically great but not quite in a central location, busy at night, not so busy lunch, and are having to close because through no fault of their own, because they just can't sustain the margins.
If there's a lack of optimism in the London market at the moment, is that different here in Dubai? Just how optimistic is the Dubai or the UAE market, if you like?
Well, I think one of the big difference between the two markets is one, this is like right now, Dubai is red hot, right? It's so hot, you get off the plane, you burn your fingers. So it coped with COVID really well. The government did a fantastic job with COVID, making sure they stayed open as long as they possibly could, and closing and only for a short period, and then making it a destination for people to come again. So restaurants could sustain that much more easily. And, you know, Dubai's Dubai, right? It's just a great place to come. You know, we've been operating here for over 20 years, and it's absolutely red hot right now for restaurants. You know, it couldn't be any more competitive.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned there. I remember the good old days back in Vare as well, executive chef back there in the early 2000s. Then, yeah, of course, Marina Social in, 2015 or thereabouts as well. Now, yeah, a couple of new ventures with the Grosvenor House. How have they sort of differed? How have they evolved as well during your time, as you said, the last 20 years or so?
Gosh, I moved here in 2000. And left 2005. And the main reason why I left was, as a young cook, I really wanted to make sure that I could fulfill my dreams to be a Michelin chef. Right? That was always a dream. And Michelin wasn't here. But now Michelin, Gourmet, Time Out, all those amazing awards are here. You can really compete against the very best. Hence why Dubai's now become this booming restaurant oasis, right? But yeah, I mean, I absolutely adore the city. I got married here, met my wife here. And you know, it's got a very fond place in my heart. So
is it saturated yet, the market?
Absolutely, yeah, but in a good way. People look at saturation as a bad thing. The great thing about saturation is it brings the best out in people, because whatever that market's saturated, only the best will survive. And what will happen here now in Dubai is, as restaurants would have had the luxury of not being so great and being fully booked and being expensive, won't have that luxury anymore. If your margins aren't absolutely spot on, so if you're not charging the right amount of money, the quality's not high, you know, you just will not survive. Then that's exactly what's happening now. London went through it in the 90s, New York went through it in the 2000s, and now Dubai's going through it right now. And that's a good thing.
In order to capitalise on that, you need good partnerships. And that's one thing that we all learned during COVID and continued after that. You've teamed up with Grosvenor House now, a well-established brand here in the market. Big friends of the Business Breakfast as well. Why them? What set them apart from others that I'm sure came bidding?
Two reasons. Number one, Pam Willoughby, who's the general manager of the Grosvenor House, is absolutely just on the ball with you know, when we were looking for new partners around the city, because, you know, at Marina, we'd sort of reached our peak of where we could go, and we wanted to offer more to the city, right? I just didn't want to come to Dubai and cook roast beef on a Sunday and steak night on a Thursday, which worked wonderfully in that restaurant. But we knew we could offer Dubai more, right? And we saw that saturation point coming. So we said, look, you know, we have to really step on the gas, or we're going to just drift into nothingness, you know? And that's, Dubai's too close to my heart to actually let that happen. Mm. So off we went. And then I looked all over the city. DIFC absolutely was as high priority for us. We looked at there, and then had a meeting with Pam. Her, you know, just the way she maintains the business, the way she's just an absolute stickler for everything what goes on in her hotels, that I knew she'd be the right partner, because you absolutely need that.
You mentioned time there, and with well over a dozen projects around the world at the moment and juggling all of those time. It's one of the challenges for someone like you, a perfectionist in your art as well, somebody who likes to give out a lot of time to your venues, to share your time between them or not.
It is, but it's also leaving the right leadership behind you. And pretty much my job now is just literally going around the world, fixing menus and just leaving leadership skills behind for the top people. And that's pretty much what I do, really. And it's just, making sure that if I don't have the right people, then I've got to either put the training in place or I've got to, gone are the days of the screamy, shouty chef running around kitchens hoping that's going to work. That doesn't work anymore. What works is absolutely giving people the right skills to make sure that they continue the work, what you do while you're here, when you're not here.
Talk to me about the balance as well. I've got about 90 seconds left as well, because I suppose one thing that people look at, the restaurateur of everyone, the art, the craft, the creativity that goes with that. And then the businessman as well, with the portfolio of businesses, cold, hard financials. How do the two mix?
They don't. So it's very rare that you get chefs who can do this. I was very fortunate to work with Gordon for, 12 years. And, when Gordon was actually in the kitchen doing what he does and running restaurants, there was nobody on the planet better than him. So I learned firsthand of how to sort of make sure that there's the very clean line between the two. When you're in the kitchen, you're an artist, you're a craftsman, you absolutely teach that properly. But when you step the other line, margins matter, training matters, customers matter, and making sure that absolutely every detail for the customer is perfect.
Jason, we could talk for a lot longer. Unfortunately, our time is up. City Social Dubai open?
City Social Dubai open. Jazz by City open. The little jazz restaurant above it. Live music Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Seven Tales, 6 days a week. Our little Japanese speakeasy in September 14th. I'm back to open up a new fine dining restaurant. 22 seats. Book from August 14th, you can book. It's going to be amazing.
So look at that. The commitment from Jason Atherton to Dubai remains, doesn't it? Jason, can't thank you enough. Thanks so much indeed for your time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
And those early doors. But thank you very much indeed. Jason Atherton, who of course has opened up down at the Grosvenor House here in Dubai. I know Deanie's looking for a restaurant for this evening. A bit of food for thought?
Not a bad idea.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Well, we're talking about the economics of video games now, because a new report says the industry will be worth $6 billion, with a B, by 2027 in this region. Video games like this one from Harry Potter.
You have the benefit of an exceptionally skilled team of witches and wizards to guide you. We leave our legacy in your hands.
Hogwarts Legacy, one of the top-selling video games of 2023. That report put together by the guys at DMCC and also Yala Esports, the founder of Yala Esports, is with us in the studio. Klaus Gajewski, friend of the Business Breakfast. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. So, the headline is that revenues from video games will double between 2021 and 2027 to $6 billion. How is that going to happen?
Oof, that's a good question. I mean, look, gaming is just growing, I think, because, I mean, at the end of the day, we're living in an attention economy. What means that currently, you can't get through a 5-second cat video, but then again, you can consume 5 hours of gaming, whether it's you playing or you watching. So since the attention is on gaming, it's just companies figuring out more and more monetization models to monetize the attention.
So if we break down that $6 billion, some of it will be parents like me just buying video games for their kids. I bought that Harry Potter game for my kids, $60, $70. I've just bought the Zelda game for my kids, $60, $70. But there's more to it than that. There's development, isn't there? And there's competitions, which is the space that you operate in.
Yeah, I want to first just break the news for you that $60, it's probably not going to end there, because then once they get into the game, they want to get your credit card and spend even more money inside that same game.
I need a sword.
That's bad news for you. So it's not only about buying the game one time, for the next however long they're going to play, they're going to probably be spending a couple hundred dollars more on that same game. But yeah, it's so much more than just these games. There's all the events around it. Also, obviously, like what we do at ELA Esports, for example. We use gaming as a medium for marketing. So a lot of marketing dollars, marketing campaigns are all around gaming because that's, again, where the attention is. So it's so much more than just playing. Like, gaming is basically the future of entertainment. It's storytelling combined with, you know, technology. And basically, all together, that's where the attention is.
We had back in February the Saudi Arabia-based gaming and esports company Savvy Games Group, which is fully owned by the Sovereign Wealth Fund there, investing $250 million in a Chinese esports operator. Why is that a good investment? That's a lot of money, Klaus.
So, look, the events for esports and gaming is obviously super important. Tournaments, you know, like there was this big debate, like, oh, should esports be part of Olympics and all that stuff? And we kind of went from like Olympics, esports need Olympics, to now like Olympics needs esports, you know. that's been a kind of nice change for the decade.
Is that happening?
I'm very much in the camp, you know, Olympics needs esports, because people are actually watching esports, whereas, at least according to the data, the Olympics are not doing the greatest, let's say. So I think, you know, we can kind of like, we can do our own Olympics, let's say. But point being here, why your question, why you know, events companies and events are good, is obviously like that's one way of kind of really segmenting this gaming. And that's honestly something that even we at Yalla Esports are looking like. How can we make something, let's say, locally relevant, you know, like an event, an IP, and really like segment this region? Because as you said, these big moves makes the global industry looking at, hey, what are they doing in the Middle East in gaming?
I was up about 6 months ago with my kids. They're aged 10 and 12, love their video games. And there was an esports event happening up at Expo. I can't remember if it was Call of Duty or World of Warcraft, but it was one of those kind of fighting games.
Okay.
And you got 10 teams competing against each other. And it was a good event. It was done well. But it wasn't rammed. You know, there were maybe a couple of hundred people there. And if someone shot someone, they'd be, hey, people would cheer. But it wasn't a mega event. And that's not a criticism, it's just an observation. How many people are really going to go and watch an esports event?
That's a very good observation, and that's kind of what we are trying to solve. So basically the problem is that, like, there isn't yet really built that local fandom. You know, if you want to look at, for example, last weekend, there was the last CSGO major in Paris. CSGO is a game, and major is basically, let's say, the world championship. It's like one of the highest tier of a CSGO tournament. And there was the last one in Paris, you know, and it's Accord Arena, I think it's called, you know, fully packed. Like, we're talking like tens of thousands of people physically there, and then obviously millions watching online across the globe. So, first of all, always when you look at the physical event, you need to remember that actually esports and gaming, it's a lot more kind of online views. Like, there's always a million people watching across the globe. But yeah, like we are kind of lacking that local fandom that will then bring tens of thousands of people into the arenas here locally. But we are working on that as a community together, and you know, building that relevance and fandom.
Finally, what is the gender breakdown? We were chatting earlier, and our intuition is that it's probably skewed towards males rather than females, but we don't know. What does the data tell us?
So you're on the right track, but usually people think it's something like, you know, 80-20 or something. It's actually not. Also depends a bit on the game, genre, and country. But abroad, it's like literally 40, 45, 50, like 60, 50. So 45 to 55 or 40 to 60.
What about your home country?
I mean, from Finland and Nordics, I would definitely say that there's a lot of girls that play. But also Saudi, for example, when I saw the first data, that was also like definitely pushing very close to the 50-50. So it's not a Nordics only thing. Look, I think it's only because a decade ago or so, it was kind of like boys were supposed to, you know, play with gadgets, where girls were supposed to play with dolls. But that is not the case anymore. The girls will get the gadgets also when they are young. So we're going to get to 50-50. And to be honest, sometimes I even feel that pro gamers, girls might be even better, because they can like kind of handle pressure and they think a bit differently in different situations. Well, guys might be too aggressive. So I'm confident in girl gamers.
Klaus, we'll leave it there. Great talking to you as ever. Appreciate your time. That is the founder of Yala Esports, Klaus Kajetski, one of the people behind this new report that says the video game industry in the Middle East will be worth $6 billion by 2027.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.